This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Good morning and welcome to Minnesota Law. Tom Schroyer is in studio today and Jim Vetter is back from the Family Law Practice Group at Moss and Barnett. And Tom, always great to see you.
Thank you, Steve. It is always fun to be here, and to have Jim Vetter is also a special treat. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you much. I appreciate that.
As we've told our listeners before, Jim Vetter is one of the senior shareholders in Moss and Barnett's Distinguished Family Law Group, and Jim is indeed a highly distinguished practitioner of the in the field of family law as well, and it brings great experience and expertise to the topic we're going to be talking about today, which is the use of what are called legal presumptions to decide cases in family court. Jim, this is an interesting topic. How did you happen to think of it?
Well, I tell you, I have had a number of calls over the years where people come in and they'll say, well, I've heard from my cousin's friend that I'm entitled to something, and it's often one of these presumptions that they're talking about. Unfortunately, the presumption that they're talking about is often wrong, or they've got the wrong idea about what the presumption is. So I thought, what an interesting topic, because so many people seem to be confused about these presumptions in family law.
You know, when I hear the word presumption, of course, being a lawyer, I know legally what it means. But in my normal life, I would say a presumption is sort of a rule of thumb, a guideline, and maybe a starting point for thinking about a problem that I might change my mind about after I give it some more thought or hear some more information. Is that a good way to look at the concept of legal presumptions here for our listeners?
Tom, that's an excellent way to look at a legal presumption. It's a starting point. In layman's terms, it's a starting point. It's not the end point. It's not something you can say, I've got this presumption, that's ultimately what's going to happen. What you've got to do, if you've got the presumption in your favor, is you've got to still present evidence to prove it. And even if you do, the other side gets to try to rebut it by presenting evidence that's showing that it ought not to be adopted. So it's just a starting point. Don't rely on it to be the end result.
They say that most of our law is made, 90% of our law, they say, is made by lawyers negotiating deals on behalf of clients outside of the courtroom. Would that be an area where a presumption of how a judge is going to rule might come into play in terms of resolving a family law case?
Absolutely, Tom. You know, we use these presumptions when we negotiate quite a bit, and it's one of those things where you're going to have people saying, well, look, I'm entitled to this. The presumption is for this. Why shouldn't I get this? And it's a good argument. It's a good argument in a settlement proceeding. It's a good argument if you're in court that at the very least you start from this. And they do help people to come to settlement. So that there's some value to the presumptions, especially in family law where courts have so much discretion. You know, our judges and referees, we'll call them judicial officers overall, have a fair amount of authority to come up with something that they think is right and fair. These presumptions help them in doing that job.
Jim, once upon a time when we've talked about family law, there was a presumption that mom got custody of the kids. I mean, wasn't that the case way back when that, you know, rarely, if ever, did dad get custody? It was always mom.
You know, Steve, that is interesting. You have got a heck of a memory, because there was a case several years ago. It was called the Piccola case. And what they did is they had adopted what was called the Tender's Years Doctrine. And that meant that we were going to look at, effectively, where did the kid spend most of their time with early in their life? Well, that typically was mom, just the way our society came up. In sort of divided the responsibility for parenting and working. So oftentimes it did favor mom. Now, if you look at our current statute, you know, which it deals with custody and parenting time, there's no gender presumption for mom or dad at this point. I say that there still are factors that might weigh in favor of mom or dad. I mean, for instance, the primary caretaker factor. That still probably is going to weigh more in favor of mom, particularly if a kid is fairly young, because they've typically been more responsible for that.
Interesting that the courts use these presumptions. What are the sources of them? Is it made by judges? Is it made by the legislature? How do these presumptions come to pass?
Tom, excellent question. The presumptions come from the legislature. They codify them in our statutes, and that's where the attorneys get them from. Now, the judges in our courts also create some presumptions. They're not quite the same, though, as a legislative presumption. But our courts give more guidance, precedents, where they'll say, this is the result that ought to happen with these facts. It's not a presumption. It's a precedent. The legislature comes up with the presumptions.
So what do you say to someone when they call you for the first time and they say, you know what, I have an issue involving parenting time, or I want to know how much I'm going to have to pay for alimony or marital support, I should say, or how much I'm going to get in the property settlement. And I've heard that the presumption is that I get X, Y, or Z. What do you tell people in that circumstance? Are they going to get it? Or do you have to temper their expectations? Or do you encourage that and fan the flame, so to speak?
No. Excellent question, Tom. I like that one a lot. I have to tell you, and this is something I know I've said on this program before, it depends. I mean, that's so often, which I know is the answer Steve loves. But and I often have to tell people.
I use it all the time now. At my other job, I use it all the time. People get a kick out of it. I always give you credit, Jim.
Well, I appreciate that, Steve, because it so often does depend. There's so many facts that go into to making a decision. It's funny you say that, because I was at a legal education thing recently, and there was a judge up there. And one of the lawyers gave a few facts and said, well, now, judge, what happens with this? And the judge said, well, it depends. And it could turn on a number of different factors. So often you'll talk with the client about the presumption and you'll say, well, you know, it could, but let's talk about the facts of your case and let's see how that will impact the presumption that we're talking about.
All right. Let's get started and then talk a little bit more specifically about each of these presumptions. But perhaps one of the biggest is the presumption about who gets legal and physical and parenting time custody for the children.
Yeah, and I think that is an excellent place to start. First with legal custody, so that our listeners kind of understand what that is. That's major decisions over education, religion, and health care. And there's a presumption in favor of joint legal custody in that regard. So absent there being domestic abuse, there's the presumption in favor of joint legal. If there is domestic abuse, then the presumption is just the opposite. Then it's that it ought to be sole legal custody in favor of the person who's not the abuser. I tell you, this is an area where I don't think there's as much of an issue about joint legal custody as there probably is the physical custody, which is the physical placement of the child. Because oftentimes parents don't have disagreements, particularly if it's a dissolution or a divorce, over education, healthcare, religion, because they've established these things. The kid's gone to a particular church. They've gone to a particular school. The healthcare parents may disagree a little bit about things. One area where I found more and more is, you know, medication. Should a child be on ADHD medication?
Oh, that's interesting.
Issue that seems to come up quite a bit, where one parent says, no, I don't think our child needs this medication. The doctor and the other parent are saying, well, they absolutely do. And that's an area where, you know, you may have this presumption in favor of joint legal custody, but the court has to look at that situation and say, are these people ideally going to – is this going to be good for the kid, best for the kid, if they've got joint legal custody?
We have more on the way. Jim Vetter in studio today with Tom Schroyer on Minnesota Law, the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. And by the way, if you have a question for Jim or Tom, feel free to call the program. Here are the numbers, 651-989-9226, toll free, 1-866-989-9226. You can text the studio as well at 81807. That's 81807.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett's attorneys help to found and remain active in the Minnesota Legal Advice Clinics and similar organizations, including the Fund for the Legal Aid Society?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back to Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturdays between 11 and noon. For more, go online, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Tom Schroyer, Jim Vetter, studio, Family Law in the Spotlight, the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. If you have a question, feel free to call or text 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Text, great way to go, 81807. Tom?
Thanks, Steve. We just talked with Jim Vetter about the presumptions in family law concerning legal custody for children following a divorce. And that, of course, concerns the issues of who gets to make decisions about education, religion, health care, and the like. Jim, there are other aspects to parenting that come into play here. One is physical custody. Are there presumptions about how much physical custody any of the divorced couple get to have?
Yeah, you know, there are, Tom, and I'm going to kind of hit two topics here together, physical custody and parenting time. There's no presumption with respect to physical custody, and physical custody is where the child resides. Actually, if you look at the statute, it's a real kind of oblique, vague definition. It's just, you know, we're going to – how you divide the residence and daily control and routine of the child. So it doesn't help too much in terms of that. But then when you get to parenting time – there is a presumption in place. There's a presumption that a parent is entitled to at least 25% of the parenting time. And this has been a hot topic with our legislature over the last several years, the physical custody and the parenting time. There have been a lot of proposals to get joint physical custody as a presumption from the legislature, and that the parenting time ought to be, and we've seen 45.1% of the time, we've seen 35% of the time. And I know, Tom, the 45.1% of the time always strikes you as interesting.
Right, right. I get an extra half hour every other week, right?
And that's exactly right. And, you know, it's tied solely to child support. And that's because the child support law is if you've got 45.1% of the time, you're going to pay less child support. I tell you, I don't know that there's a right or wrong presumption when you're talking about parenting time. I mean, it seems to me it's a case-by-case basis. You know, 25%, if you look at a four-week schedule, 28 days, you're talking 7 days. You know, and the people ask me, I know, Steve, you kind of sometimes wonder, well, how do you measure it? I mean, well, how do you measure 25%? You know, is it overnights? Is it days? Well, the statute indicates you're supposed to look at overnights, but that the court can look at something else that might be substantial. I tell you, from my perspective, most of the parenting is done during the day. I mean, you know, there's some stuff at night, particularly if you've got a younger kid who, you know, wakes up in the middle of the night. But most of your parenting is done between, what, 7 in the morning, 10 o'clock at night. You know, for older kids, that may differ a little bit. But I think the focus ought to not be on a presumption hitting a particular percentage as much as it ought to be what's best for that particular child.
And a lot of the memories are made in the evening, sporting events, cultural events, whether it's music or theater or whatever, whatever activities the kids are into, being a part of that is the big deal.
You know, Steve, that's an excellent point. And I think that gets lost so often in these parenting time disputes is nobody typically is prohibited from going to these events. You know, if your kid's playing hockey, soccer, football, basketball, baseball, in plays or in playing an instrument, go to the events, for God's sakes. I mean, that is where kids really are looking to see if their parents are there. Now, that may not always get factored in on this 25%, but I can tell you that's probably going to make more of a difference to your child than whether or not you had 25% of the time or 35% of the time.
One of the other things I wanted to bring up is as the children get older, we've talked about this before, the 15, 16, 17-year-olds are not adults. I would presume that they would be under some sort of jurisdiction of the family court and divorce decrees. But at the end of the day, you're not going to tell a 15 or 16-year-old, right now you got to spend time with mom or you got to spend time with dad. How does that get sorted out?
I swear to God, Steve, you must call me on an every other week basis because I get that question about every other week. And this is one of the areas where there are presumptions that exist in other states. There's none in Minnesota about a particular age where a child gets to make a decision. There are other states that have pinned it, I think, as young as 13 years of age. And I just look at the danger in that. I mean, you put that kind of control into a 13-year-old, you know, you're going to live primarily with mom or dad. Well, who's to say mom or dad don't say, hey, Johnny, you come live with me and I don't have to pay child support, I'll buy you a new car. You don't have any rules. You can do whatever you want. In Minnesota, we don't have that, but our judges and referees look at what's best for a child. And if you've got a kid who really is sophisticated, really kind of is a smart kid and can make right decisions, they're going to look at that. And as the kid gets older, you're absolutely right, Steve. You're going to have a hard time telling a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid you're going to be at this particular place at this particular time, particularly if they don't want to be. And typically at that age, they want to be with their friends more than their parents anyway.
Yeah, the whole area, it seems to me, is fraught with major issues and lots of discussion. And so I can see the need for a presumption, but it does seem to me to be one that would be pretty hard to enforce on a consistent basis.
Tom, that's absolutely right. I mean, the enforcement is one thing the judges and the referees will tell you every time is you can come up with any schedule you want, but ultimately in terms of enforcement, what am I going to do with your 15 or 16-year-old kid? You're going to bring them into the courtroom and I'm going to give them a lecture? Are you going to try to hold them in contempt of court? The reality is that a lot of these judicial officers have kids themselves, and they know that's just not practical.
We have more on the way. Great topic today, the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. Tom Schroyer hosting Jim Vetter today. Phone lines are open if you have a question for Jim or Tom. The phone number is 651-989-9226, toll-free, 1-866-989-9226. Texas Studio, 81807. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
As we welcome the cool days of autumn here in Minnesota, we're also preparing for the cold days of winter that are sure to follow. We're ready. Are you? News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturdays between 11 and noon. Tom Schroyer is our host. Jim Vetter in today, the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. We have some phone lines open for you, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Texas Studio, 81807. That's 81807. Let's go to the phone lines. Pat in Stillwater, you're on with Tom and Jim. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question regarding visitation, but it's in a different type of setting. There is no divorce involved. It's grandparent visitation when the parents are not particularly cooperating in this. So do you understand?
Yeah, I think I understand the question, Pat, and it's a good question at that. In terms of grandparent visitation, there is no presumption that a grandparent is entitled to any certain amount of visitation at all. Grandparents do have a right to request visitation with their child, and it's really to the court's discretion on what's best in that particular case. There was a Court of Appeals case that came out, I think it was maybe a couple of years ago now, that addressed this issue specifically. And there, I think the grandparents got one weekend per month. So, that might be something that you could use as precedence. Again, not as a presumption, though.
All right. We're going to be talking about, another presumption. That involves the split up of the property when a marriage comes to an end. And I know, Jim, that there's a presumption that changes depending upon when the property was acquired and how it came into the possession of one or the other of the spouses or both of them.
Tom, that's absolutely correct. In terms of property, there's a presumption that all property obtained during the marriage, regardless of source, is marital property, which is property that's going to be divided between the two parties. If you want to rebut that presumption, if you want the court not to follow that presumption, then you have to prove that the property is non-marital property, meaning that it was acquired before the marriage, is the result of an inheritance, a gift, protected by an antenuptial agreement. Those are really are acquired after the valuation date is the other one. Those are really the areas where you can rebut it. This is an area where, people struggle with this because, for instance, let's just a scenario, Steve. Let's say you get a million-dollar inheritance from your uncle in Ohio because he thought you just were a really good guy, and you get divorced, and you say, well, I don't have to do anything. That's just my inheritance. I got it during the marriage, but it was just to me. If you don't do anything, the court's going to divide that money equally. Not necessarily equally, but equitably at the very least. And you've got the obligation to rebut the presumption. You've got to come in and say, no, this was my inheritance, and you've got to prove it. Now, people often ask, and I think, Tom, you asked me earlier, well, what's my burden of proof on that? What do I have to come in and prove? And it's more likely than not that you got this money as an inheritance. And I tell people, you know, try to document it as well as you can, because your testimony may not be enough on that.
Would a copy of the will that spelled out you receiving this money be enough proof?
Boy, I tell you, Steve, we were talking off air about you getting an honorary legal degree here. I think you've earned it. You're absolutely right. Get copies of the estate documents. If it's a will, if it's a trust, show the transfer going from your uncle's estate to your bank account, and then provide the bank account statements that show it was transferred into an investment account or went into a house or something else. But have a paper trail. That's the best way to do it. You're not required to have a paper trail. But if you really want to hedge your bets on it, I would do that.
On this topic, from the text line, what can be done to collect personal property awarded in a divorce decree order that the other spouse refuses to or has already sold? This kind of gets into the bigger picture over the years of collections. You get a judgment, and then the tough work of actually collecting on that judgment begins.
Yeah, and that's a good question, because it is tough. And if you've got a judgment, you could do a few things with it. I mean, you can try to garnish wages if they've got a job and there's something that you can get out of it. Otherwise, you can try to lien property. I mean, that's the other thing. If they've got real property or some kind of an account that you can go after. Absent that, I mean, it's not a lot. I suppose if it's really just personal property, meaning it's, you know, the sofa, and you're saying, well, I can't get the sofa, they won't give it to me, you could try to get the local sheriff to come in and help you get it, and you could get the court to order that the sheriff will help you come and get it. And that's a tough thing to do, though, and if there's kids involved, that can be a real tough scene to have.
Yeah, we've had a number of shows, Steve's right, over the years here in Minnesota Law about how to execute on judgments. And, of course, our listeners can go to the website, mossandbarnett.com, or mossandbarnett.wccco.com. Did I get that right, Steve?
Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com.
That's it. That's
We're there.
It. All right. So there are podcasts, I should say, of those prior shows, which provide tips on how to do judgment collection, because that is something that isn't, strictly speaking, a family law issue.
No, it comes up in family law cases, because so often you get a judgment against somebody. But yes, in terms of the collections, I definitely go back and listen to the past programs.
Now, in terms of this property presumption, let's say that we have property that was acquired during the marriage. It's clearly marital property. Is there a presumption on how that gets split up now in Minnesota?
You know, Tom, it's interesting. In Minnesota, we don't have a presumption for 50-50 or any kind of percentage.
You know, I got to tell you, I thought there was a 50-50 presumption here in Minnesota. That's not true, though.
That is not true. Our statute says it's to be a just and equitable division. Now, that could mean 50-50, and in a lot of cases it does. But it doesn't necessarily require that. The court is to look at a number of factors. And it's, Tom, your question's very pointed, because there's a presumption within those factors. There's what's called a conclusive presumption, meaning you can't rebut it. And there's a conclusive presumption that both parties made a substantial contribution to the acquisition of that property during the marriage. Now, I always think that's kind of an interesting conclusive presumption, because you can't rebut it. I think about the small business owner, the professional athlete, the lawyer, the doctor, who did a fair amount of work to get them to the point where they could actually acquire that property. And it wasn't just that the day you got married, you suddenly were able to do it. It was something you had to work to get to. And I don't know that that ought to be a conclusive presumption. I think you could have a rebuttable presumption, meaning you could present alternative evidence on it.
But it's conclusive because the legislature said so?
That's exactly right. The legislature specifically said this is a conclusive presumption.
We have more on the way. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We'll come to Molly following a break. She has a question for Jim and Tom. Today on the program, it is the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorney Clifford A. Taney Jr. went on to fame while serving during World War II as general counsel to the super-secret nuclear development program of the U.S. Army, known as the Manhattan Project?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Jim Vetter, Tom Schroyer in studio. The presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. Let's go to the phones real quick. Molly's been waiting. Molly, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, my husband filed for a legal separation, and I didn't really see this coming. He wants me to go and sign the separation document instead of having it served to me. He just wants me to sign it. My first question is, should I sign it without getting an attorney? And also, how long do I have to sign that document once it's been filed?
Molly, a couple of things here. And with response to your first question, yes, absolutely. I think you should talk with an attorney about it because I'm sure there are a lot more facts. I mean, previously, we were talking about the it depends. And that's kind of the answer to the second question is, should you sign it? It depends. It depends on what the facts are and what your situation is. In terms of timing, I believe you've got 30 days to sign it from the date of service. So you've got some time to figure things out, and you should. Certainly avail yourself of that opportunity because once you sign it, the court will enforce it, and it's very hard to undo the things once they become a court order.
You know, that question does lead into another presumption we were going to talk about, and that is the presumption about whether a post-marital agreement, a post-nuptial agreement, is enforceable because it comes up in the context of people trying a legal separation, as I understand it.
Yeah, Tom, good question, because with a post-nuptial agreement, it is presumed to be unenforceable if somebody commences a divorce within 2 years of having signed it. Now, keep in mind, a post-nuptial agreement is after you've been married.
Let's get our minds around this because, you know, Steve asked a good question a few years ago on our show. How would you actually raise the question of getting someone to sign an antenuptial? How would you do it for a discussion with your wife about how to split your assets up in the event of a divorce? I mean, that's a really amazing trick, huh?
I think that's a very tough thing. I think one thing I've seen people will say is, look, if we don't have this discussion, I will get divorced. And if that's the case, and you're the person they're trying to give the postnuptial to, you might be best off just looking at whether or not divorce is the right option. And certainly if it is, go forward with it. But you can get yourself into kind of a dangerous situation with that because if you sign one of these agreements and they wait the 2 years, the agreement is then presumed enforceable. So now, again, the court's going to look at the facts, but at least the presumption is that this postnuptial is enforceable. Our legislature wanted to protect people with the 2-year requirement so that, you know, you didn't go have someone sign the postnuptial agreement and then 2 weeks later you go into court and say, all right, now I got everything I wanted and we'll just get this thing done rather quickly, where you may have given somebody false hope that they could save the marriage by having signed it.
How about on the other side of the coin, if it's a premarital or antenuptial agreement, are there presumptions that apply to whether those are enforceable, and if so, to what extent?
Yeah, that Tom, is presumed enforceable from day one, and that's because people are in a little different situation at that point. They're not already married. Presumably, people can walk away from each other at that point. You know, you don't have as much pressure as you're already married. So it's presumed enforceable. With that being said, the court is still going to look at, is it substantively fair? So, you know, we've kind of had this discussion with the presumptions. Don't solely rely on those. If you got an antenuptial agreement, don't say, oh, that's the end of it. I've got it. Make sure it's fair. I mean, so oftentimes people come in with an antenuptial agreement and they want to make it so one-sided that it's not fair. And keep in mind, the court's going to be your backstop on that to determine whether it ultimately gets enforced.
So pigs keep getting fed and hogs get slaughtered.
Pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered.
All right.
And on that note, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Tom Schroyer, Jim Vetter, the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. Final segment of the program, moments away on News Radio 830 WCECO.
Listen to WCECO on FM at 1029 KMNB HD2, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And while you're there, check out the nonstop Buzzin' Country. Just one click away. Buzzin' at 1029.
Welcome back one more time. Tom Schroyer, Jim Vetter. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Burnett, the presumptions of family law and how to challenge them. Tom?
We have just a few short moments left with Jim Vetter to talk about these presumptions. A couple of the bigger ones, Jim, that we didn't get time to talk about are the presumptions for child support and marital support.
You know, it's interesting. With respect to child support and spousal maintenance, people often say, well, is there any presumption that a parent can work? And in terms of spousal maintenance, there isn't. But there was a recent case, this Passholt case. He works for Fox 9. He's a news anchor there. And if you look at that case, they say, well, his wife, who had been not unemployed, she'd been a yoga instructor for several years, actually a lot of years. And they said, well, no, she can go back and be a school teacher again and earn more income. So Mr. Passholt pays less spousal maintenance. Now, you look at that and you compare that with child support. Child support, there is a presumption that a parent can work. There's a presumption that a parent can work 40 hours per week full-time, earning 150% of federal minimum wage, which translates out to be about $1,900 per month. I tell you what, in this economy, I don't know that either of those are necessarily right, because it's tough right now to find a job if you're qualified. Now, you think of a lot of these people who've been out of the workforce potentially or don't have a lot of education. It can be tough to find such a job at this time.
You know, I must say, too, I find it I'm not so sure it's entirely fair to change these presumptions. You know, midstream, people get married, they have children, they have careers, or they opt out of the workforce to raise the family with the expectation they'll have some of these legal presumptions, and then boom, somebody at the legislature gets enough votes and they make a change. It's retroactive in the sense that it affects all marriages going forward from that time on. But, you know, these things have to be carefully considered. And really, I just wonder, do the courts take into account the fact of these legacy issues that people have really kind of embedded in their marriages?
You know, they do, but it's changed a bit. I mean, the Passholt case really did change that in spousal maintenance. I mean, it was kind of time where before, people looked a little more carefully at, okay, what are the roles here that we've had? And now it's kind of almost a presumption that, all right, parents are going to have to get out and work. I don't care how long you've been out of the workforce. You know, it's just going to be the reality. And with the economy being what it is, I mean, there's some merit to that. You've got to try to get as much income as you can. But in certain situations where one spouse makes a lot of income, I don't know that it's the right decision.
All right, Jim, we've got to run. A pleasure. We've learned a lot on the program today, the presumptions of family law, and how to challenge them. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And Tom, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Tom, what have we got coming up next week?
We're going to be having a rebroadcast of one of our very best shows with Tony Merrick, a Moss & Burnett securities and equity financing attorney, who is going to be talking about how to raise capital for private, closely held businesses. And it's a great program, and we hope folks will have a chance to catch up with Tony Merrick next week.
That is, Saturday is between 11 and noon, Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. And for more on today's program and podcast, go online, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. We have all the news coming up at noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO.